Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the partial withdrawal of Russian troops at the Ukrainian border and the visit by Russia's Prime Minister to Crimea that the new government in Kiev is condemning. We will speak with Andrew Cutchins, a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Relations, Russia and Eurasia program, and discuss his criticism of President Obama's handling of the crisis with Putin over Russia's annexation of Crimea. And Andrew Cutchins' article at CNN, Does Obama Really Understand Putin? We will also explore possible ways to avoid a new tit-for-tat Cold War dynamic that seems all but inevitable as the recent talks between Secretary of State Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov appear to have gone nowhere, and relations between Putin and the United States continue to deteriorate. Then, with the release of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's latest report that global warming poses a growing threat to security, food supply, and human life, with a warning that the worst is yet to come, Elizabeth Colbert, a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, joins us. We'll discuss whether the message that comes out of this report that the world has to adapt and mitigate means that it is too late to stop global warming, and what can be done to overcome the organized denial of the problem that is thwarting efforts to address an impending catastrophe. And joining us now is Andrew Cutchins, a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Relations, Russia and Eurasian Program, as well as the former director of the Russian and Eurasian Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His recent publications include Perspective, What's to Follow the Demise of the U.S.-Russian Reset, The End of the Reset, Russia's Foreign Policy, Continuity in Change. And he has an article at CNN, Does Obama Really Understand Putin? Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Cutchins.
My pleasure, Ian.
And what's your sense of the Putin's order of a partial withdrawal of the forces massed on the Ukrainian border? He mentioned that in a phone conversation with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, but he also talked about steps needed to stabilize the situation in Ukraine and Transnistria. Well, isn't that a bit ironic? I mean, isn't Putin the one that's destabilizing Ukraine and Transnistria?
Well, you and I would think so. I think, Ian. But you know, Mr. Putin may have a different conceptual framework and map that he's working on. What can I say about the removal of some of the troops from the Ukrainian border? Well, that means it's probably less likely that a military invasion of Russian military invasion of Ukraine will take place tomorrow. You know, we don't know what Mr. Putin is actually planning on doing. Mr. Putin may, at this time, may not know himself exactly what he is going to do in Ukraine. But one thing I'm virtually certain of, Ian, and that is that for Mr. Putin to win Crimea and to essentially lose the rest of Ukraine, that is not a satisfactory outcome for him at all. So I would expect him to continue to apply various measures to essentially deprive Ukraine of its sovereignty and its independence.
So just in terms of the withdrawal, apparently it's only about 500 men. It's the 15th Separate Motor Rifle Brigade Battalion. So there's still 40,000 soldiers there in place. There was talk that maybe having taken Ukraine, where, by the way, Prime Minister Medvedev is there and the Ukrainian government have denounced his visit, does Russia need a land corridor to this newly seized territory? I mean, otherwise, there's no bridge across at Kerch, is there?
Or well, Kerch. Does a boa constrictor need to eat? Well, I don't mean to be facetious, but no, certainly Russia does not need a land corridor to Transnistria.
Or to Crimea, I was saying. You know, what about
Well, no, not necessarily. But you know, I think what we're facing here, Ian, is that Mr. Putin is accelerating the project for, you know, building a greater Russia. It's not something that's, you know, a remake of the Soviet Union, but it's a Russia certainly that's greater than its territorial extent right now. And, you know, he has been willing to use military instruments. He's been using economic instruments. He's been using cyber warfare instruments. He's been using intelligence instruments. He's been busing people across the Ukrainian border to stir things up. There are all kinds of tools that he's using. And certainly what he doesn't want to see is the existence of a government in Kyiv that can be viewed as more legitimate. So I think that, you know, elections are scheduled for May 25th in Ukraine. So I think between, you know, now and then, we're going to continue to see various kinds of pressure applied by Moscow, either to prevent those elections from happening, or to reconfigure the territorial facts on the ground, or to make sure that whoever might be elected in such an election is very, very, very sympathetic towards the interests of Moscow, and certainly far more trustworthy than Mr. Yanukovych.
Well, but isn't Yanukovych the kind of model that Putin is offering? Isn't it at the heart of what's going on in the Ukraine, a choice over a European model of governance and economics that has transparency and rule of law? And what Putin is offering, particularly now in Ukraine, is, you know, you're going to have a higher standard of living, but you're going to have, I mean, he's got this gangster, the Goblin, running the place, and Konstantinov, the speaker, is a scam artist who took a lot of money to build apartment buildings that weren't built. And that's the model. I mean, Yanukovych was a kleptocrat. By comparison to Putin, he's a small fry. But to my mind, that's really at the heart of it, is these two models. And I'm surprised that so many people in Russia accept this incredibly corrupt kleptocracy.
Well, that's a tough question. You know, Putin's popularity for the first, certainly the first 8 years when he was president, was basically due to economic prosperity growing in Russia, not necessarily due to policies that Mr. Putin implemented, but the most significant factor being both the increase in oil production and the dramatic increase in oil price. The global economic crisis, global financial crisis hit, Russia is exposed as vulnerable, but the global economy rebounded fairly quickly, the oil price rebounded fairly quickly. And so even when Mr. Putin took power, Russian economic growth was around 3 or 4%, despite the extraordinary sort of endemic corruption that existed in the country. Now, though, what's happened in the last 2 years, or almost 2 years since he's been in power, you know, Russian economic growth has stagnated to practically zero, despite the fact that oil prices are at a relatively historic high. Now, so Mr. Putin, I think, has decided to basically kind of, you know, change his game plan as to what provides him the domestic political support. It had been economic prosperity for the majority of Russians whose salaries had dramatically increased and pensions paid and all of that. Now, however, he's changing the conversation. And the emphasis is on sort of traditional conservative Russian values combined with, you know, Russia's sort of a special role for Russia in the world. To me, it kind of reminds me of going back to the 19th century Tsar Nicholas I, who was a very, very conservative, and his ideology was revolved around nationality, Russian nationality, autocracy, and orthodoxy. And Putin is playing that, and then a part of that, of course, is the efforts to rebuild something that is bigger than Russia itself. And, you know, so far he's getting payoff from it. You know, with a 10-12 point increase in popularity with the takeover of Crimea. But, you know, how long that's going to last is anybody's guess. I think, you know, at some point, I think essentially he is hastening his own demise. My worry, though, Ian, is that he's not going to go out with a whimper like Mr. Gorbachev in the Soviet Union. that we may be looking at sort of the second conclusion of the Cold War, which will be a more definitive conclusion, but I fear that it's going to be a much more bloody and conflict-ridden conclusion.
We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and continue the conversation with Andrew Cutchins.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we are rejoining the conversation with Andrew Cutchins, who's a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Relations, Russia and Eurasia Program, as well as the former director of the Russian and Eurasian Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His recent publications include Perspective, What's to Follow the Demise of the U.S.-Russian Reset, The End of the Reset, Russian Foreign Policy, Continuity and Change, and he has an article at CNN, Does Obama Really Understand Putin? So given that bleak prognosis, what's then... In your article at CNN, you're quite critical of the Obama administration, saying the only thing that surprised Putin was how weak Obama's response has been, and the administration was clearly not prepared for the contingency that Putin would act so brazenly. I spoke yesterday with Strobe Talbot, who pointed out that he disagreed with Henry Kissinger, who's apparently emphatically saying that the U.S. should assure Russia that NATO expansion into Ukraine is off the table. Strobe Talbot felt that should not be guaranteed, that at some time later Ukraine should have the option. And my sense is that Putin wouldn't be as popular as he is unless there was some collective sense of humiliation that the Russian people shared, that he was able to tap into. So why taunt the wounded bear?
Well, I think I completely agree with the argument that I pointed out in the CNN article that came out a few days ago, that I get asked the question all the time, why don't we get Putin? Why do American presidents have a hard time understanding him? And I think it kind of gets back to, it's very difficult, not only for American presidents or otherwise, but people in general, to understand the psychological trauma that several generations of Russians endured with the collapse of the Soviet Union, where from one day you go from being a superpower to the next day you're a recipient of humanitarian aid. You know, that is just, it hasn't happened to me, for example. I just can't fathom how impactful that would be to my psychology. I think it would be huge. And I think there would be some pathologies that would be associated with it. And clearly, Mr. Putin carries these grievances, on his shoulder. I joke, he's got a chip on his shoulder the size of the Rock of Gibraltar, but maybe that's underestimated. Maybe it's the size of Jupiter. And that is something that really does resonate with the Russian people. That the terms of the conclusion for the Cold War were unfair and illegitimate. And particularly the terms for the post-Cold War order were illegitimate because Russia was weak and Russia had inadequate voice, and that the West, and particularly the United States, took advantage of Russia during a period of weakness. Now one can understand why one would have that view, and we could debate the advisability of the expansion of NATO forever. And it probably will be debated forever. But when the response is to essentially to take actions, and this is what happened essentially with the military occupation in Crimea, which drastically undermine, core sort of agreements about the post-Cold War order. You know, the one that I point out repeatedly is the Budapest Memorandum, in which the Belarus, Kazakhstan, Ukraine gave up their nuclear weapons that were on their territory as part of the Soviet deployment of nuclear weapons. They gave up those weapons in return for the signatures, the promise of the Russians, the Americans, and the Brits to defend, protect the territorial integrity of those states. And here we are 20 years later, and that agreement is exposed as a complete sham. It's just amazing to me how easily, virtually without any debate about it, that we sold out on that agreement. And when you start selling out on kind of core agreements and that really attack the integrity of your word and the integrity of your credibility, that's a very, very, very dangerous, slippery slope. And my main critique of the Obama administration has been, it's not so, okay, to get surprised by what Mr. Putin pulled off in Crimea, okay, I mean, that was a heck of a maneuver he pulled off. Hats off, okay? We can't legitimately recognize it, but from a tactical standpoint, from an operational standpoint, to essentially be able to take over a territory of 2.5 million people in a bloodless manner is pretty impressive. But when we're with other measures, with that and other measures where we're really talking about depriving Ukraine of its sovereignty and its independence, that I think is just you can't go there. So I completely agree with Strobe in that we cannot have an agreement in which that we make the promise that Ukraine cannot, will not join NATO. It completely undermines all of the principles that we have stood for decades, generations. This is a decision ultimately for the Ukrainians to take themselves if they would like to join NATO, and then for NATO itself to make the decision if it should come up that they would want to embrace Ukraine. And of course, it would be unlikely to happen, or more than unlikely to happen, when there's actually a territorial dispute in a country. No country with a territorial dispute has been admitted to NATO. But it's this, one thing that really bothered me, for example, Ian, the past day, that Secretary Kerry was negotiating, having discussions with Russian Minister Lavrov, essentially about the future of Ukraine. And to me, that's a violation of Ukraine's sovereignty. The excuse is that, the Russian Federation doesn't recognize the government in Kyiv as legitimate, so the Americans can stand in. But why should we kind of buy into the Russian position on that? It's a slippery slope. No matter how you carve it, to me that is sort of a deprivation of Ukrainian sovereignty. And when we start going down that road, it's hard to see where it ends.
Well, but it seems to me, though, just obviously, there's no point in trying to go back on history, but the idea that we spent trillions on winning, in quotes, the Cold War, and then we basically didn't pony up any real aid to Russia when it really needed it, and we were sort of dancing in the end zone over our victory in the Cold War. And now we've got a situation where, you could argue that it's not that dissimilar to what happened with the Versailles Treaty that humiliated the Germans. I mean, arguably, Yeltsin's Russia was Weimar Germany, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, the analogy really holds in many respects. It was to the extent that the United States and the West, had a window of opportunity to provide aid that could have made a real difference in the direction of Russia's trajectory. I think it was a short-lived window, and it was in the fall of 1991 into the spring of 1992. And we did not deliver. We did not deliver. And I think that was a huge mistake. Now, you can't run the counterfactual to see what would happen if we had, but by that time, we had essentially kind of, the reformers in Russia had already lost. And, you know, there was the natural backlash against the reformers, because not so much of the reforms themselves, but, you know, whoever was taking over Russia back in the beginning of 1992 was basically taking over a country whose, you know, decisions about allocation of economic resources had been made on a non-market basis for, you know, 70 years. And, I mean, that legacy was going to be very, very, very hard to address. And, in fact, the Russians are still trying to address it, you know. Factories in sort of single factory towns and places that just don't make sense in a market economy, but they made sense in the Soviet sort of military industrial complex economy. So yeah, we made a big mistake. We were short sighted at that time. And you know, and that we really are seeing, I think, the kind of the Weimar Russia scenario that we feared back in the 1990s, kind of coming to pass. I mean, this regime in Moscow, it does resemble a fascist regime in many respects. And Mr. Putin is kind of giving it the Rush. It's the typical Russian flavor that there are enemies around us. We need to batten things down at home. We need to, we don't have the luxury of having, a democratic system. So we're falling back on the old Russian model of highly centralized political power, combined increasingly with, well, we're seeing more allocations to the military, but nothing along the scale of what was the Soviet Union, but much more aggressive and assertive behavior, you know, towards its neighbors. And it's not an easy policy problem to solve by any stretch of the imagination. But my kind of critique for the Obama administration for the past month is that there needs to be more resoluteness, more firmness. There needs to be more integrity to our word. You know, when we said back on February 28th, the president said that there would be, you know, significant costs incurred on the Russians if they, did a military incursion, if they annexed territory. Well, you know, the fact is we haven't. We just haven't. And the danger of that is that it creates, I think, in Mr. Putin's mind, an excessively permissive environment, which can lead him to miscalculate and make a more dramatic step that would likely, have very negative impact on the long term for him. Maybe not, but probably. I.e., let's say some kind of ground war in Ukraine. But it would not only be a tragedy for Russians and Ukrainians, but it would be just a huge setback for European security, and I think a huge setback for U.S. national interests and U.S. credibility. And I'm afraid it would be a terrible, terrible blow to Mr. Obama's legacy, and that he would be viewed as the guy that sort of lost a lot of what was won in the Cold War. And that's why I think he really, really, really needs to focus, I think, on the magnitude of what's at stake here. And we're not, you know, we're kind of not accustomed to doing that. And it's not where he wants to put his energy. We know that. You know, he wants to do nation building at home. But, you get to deal with the hand that you get. And this is a crisis of very, very serious proportions. And so for some ways, you know, I personally feel it's, I started studying the Soviet Union back in college 37 years ago, and I just feel that this is a more dangerous moment than any time since then. And so we really need to think more seriously about measures to deter Mr. Putin from doing something that is going to have really, really potentially catastrophic consequences for, a lot more than just the Ukrainians and the Russians.
Well, just in closing, Andrew Cutchins, so if we are going into this era, whether it, you know, it's going to be a sort of the Cold War light, there's still that mechanism at play that is like the Cold War of reciprocity, of tit for tat. And
right.
To me, that is, we've seen that movie before, and it's a bad one. Is there
right.
anything more imaginative? I'm not suggesting we should roll over and show our soft underbelly, but I'm suggesting something along those lines, that maybe we should try something different. Is there a way to win this guy over and to remove or assuage his paranoia? I mean, I don't know whether you heard that story from the former Secretary of the Treasury, who at the time he was dealing with the TARP crisis, the Chinese were worried that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were going to go under, and they had trillions invested, and he was trying to reassure them and get money out of the Congress. And then the Chinese told him that Putin had got in touch with them and had said, why don't we dump all of our American holdings, which would, of course, really created the 2008 crash, would have turned into the Depression. So if that's true, this guy is not our friend. But on the other hand, you don't want to make an enemy out of this guy. So is there anything we can do?
You know, I think it's going to be very, very, very hard to make him turn back. I mean, this is okay. I mean, this is a guy that's been in power for 14 years. He he feels like he is the master of his universe. It's a guy that's been underestimated all his life, I think since being a little kid. But he's found ways to, you know, to overcome that. And, you know, I think for him, that collapse of the Soviet Union was a trauma. And so I wrote in the CNN piece a few days ago that Russia is experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. And I saw that, you know, Mr. Obama said something to the effect that, well, you know, come on, that was like 20 plus years ago. Well, but the problem with trauma and traumatic stress disorder is that, you know, it can last a very, very long time. And especially if it's untreated, it simply gets worse. And, you know, I think Mr. Putin, I think, is over the time he's been in power, he's accumulated in the way he calculates just too many data points that point to one, that you know, we, particularly the United States, are the enemy, that we do seek to undermine him. We would love to see him thrown out of power. That's why he's so sensitive to regime change that takes place either at the hand of U.S. military power or at, social, economic, political forces mobilized on the ground. And, you know, here's kind of the core problem of Ukraine, in that the February 21st agreement, which, you know, we signed, the Europeans signed, the Russians were present but did not sign, which called for Mr. Yanukovych to stay in power for another 10 months. And the people on Maidan in the square, they revolted, didn't accept that. Which I expected to happen, not because I wanted it to happen, but just because of the situation. And then Putin's read on that is that that's a West-supported coup, you know? But it's not a West-supported coup. The Europeans didn't want that to happen. The Obama administration didn't want to happen. It was something that was kind of uncontrollable. But he will always read that it is external forces that are kind of at the hand, that are the most powerful influence there. And, you know, whether he believes that because he actually believes it or whether it's just sort of instrumental and useful for him to believe it that way because it justifies stepping very, very hard on any sort of socially mobilized resistance or opposition in Russia, I can't answer that. But that's the way he behaves. So I think for me, the most important thing we can do in the near term is to prevent the situation getting worse. And I think for that, we really do need to put more attention to both on the economic side and on the military side, you know, increasing the capacity of the Ukrainian government to deter Russia. And I'm not talking about anything like troops on the ground or an Article 5 commitment to Ukraine, but just to change the calculation for what the cost would be, let's say, if a military invasion were to take place. And then simultaneously and we've been doing better on this score, particularly the IMF package coming through, you know, to get the funds to the Ukrainian government to ensure that, one, they don't go bankrupt before the elections on May 21st, but that they have a real, program and the capacity to implement that program in place over the next couple of years, where they can put themselves in a position where they actually are more sovereign and independent. Because the biggest problem for Ukraine is the tremendous disappointment of the three governments after the Orange Revolution. I mean, they were virtually useless from the standpoint of putting Ukraine in a stronger economic position to be able to act more independently. As you noted, these are basically, you know, various forms of kleptocracies, not too dissimilar from that which Vladimir Putin runs in Moscow. So, you know, a lot of it's also on the, you know, on the Ukrainians themselves, and hopefully, you know, kind of like Samuel Johnson said about the imminence of a beheading will focus the mind. That, you know, they'll realize that, you know, their sovereignty really is on the line here. They really are in danger, and they've got to get it right this time. Otherwise, it's going to be a very, very bad outcome in which their sovereignty is going to perhaps go away for a very, very, very long time.
Well, Andrew Cutchins, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Cutchins, who's a senior fellow and director of the Center for Strategic and International Relations, Russia and Eurasia Program, as well as the former director of the Russian and Eurasian Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His recent publications include Perspective, What's to Follow the Demise of the U.S.-Russian Reset, The End of the Reset, Russian Foreign Policy, Continuity and Change, and he has an article at CNN, Does Obama Really Understand Putin? We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the new report from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change with Elizabeth Colbert.
I have breathed all the sea. You're our fan, prophecy. Our destiny we will not hide. When the sun comes up, it will be on your side.
Cracked, dead, bent, scream as the fight for life. I can feel death, can see its beady eyes. All these things into position. All these things are one day swallowed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elizabeth Colbert, who has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1999. Her three-part series on global warming, The Climate of Man, won the 2006 National Magazine Award for Public Interest, the 2005 American Association for the Advancement of Sciences Journalism Award, and the 2006 National Academy's Communication Award. She is the author of The Prophet of Love and Other Tales of Power and Deceit, and Field Notes from a Catastrophe, and her latest book just out is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Colbert.
Thanks for having me.
And we happen to be talking on the same day that the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change have issued their report, which is quite alarming, of course, and the headline is that the worst is yet to come. But the message from this, the IPCC, seems to be that the world has to adapt and the world has to mitigate. How about prevent? Have we passed the point where we can't prevent?
I'm afraid we have passed the point where we can't prevent some additional climate change. I mean, the climate has already changed. We've probably increased average global temperatures by around, let's say, a degree Fahrenheit, roughly. And what people really need to understand about climate change is that there's a lot of inertia in the climate system. And so there's a lot of scientists speak about warming that's already in the pipeline. And that is quite probably another, let's say, degree or so. So and that is, you know, sort of baked into the system. How's that? And we're not going to prevent that. What we do really need to try to prevent is going beyond that. You, I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about this idea that we really need to try to limit climate warming to 2 degrees Celsius or less. That's roughly 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. We may still have time to do that, but only if we act really, really dramatically and really, really quickly. We seem to be sort of blowing past that threshold pretty quickly.
So would the idea that crop yields, again, which are already going down, will drop precipitously, there'll be food shortages, already fish catches in the tropics are down between 40 and 60%, They're down, but they're projected to fall by between 40 and 60%. At what point does that get our attention, do you think?
Well, you know, that that is the question of our time, isn't it? I mean, there have certainly been a number of really serious weather-related disasters that quite probably have a climate change component. There have been, you know, we're having a very serious drought in the American Southwest in California, and from where we get a lot of our food, as you Californians certainly know, we're having a very serious drought. In Australia, there's been terrible drought and terrible, terrible heat waves during this past summer, their summer. And so we keep getting all of these signals. The Arctic ice cap is melting away. The Arctic ice cap has been around, you know, for millions of years. And we don't seem to be able to really respond to that in any sort of appropriate way. So I honestly don't know what it's going to take.
Well, it's extraordinary to think that, Elizabeth Colbert, that so much of our political debate in this country is still mired in denial. I understand why denial is appealing. I guess that was the notion that former Vice President Al Gore had in the title of his film, The Inconvenient Truth. It is inconvenient, but it's as long as we debate whether or not it's real or not, that seems to be a deliberate delaying tactic. And clearly we're running out of time, if not having run out of time. So what is your sense of how we can break that cycle of denial, or at least that constituency of denial?
You know, I wish I had the answer to that. I spent, you know, really the last 10 years writing about this topic. I have written this story every way I can think of to write about it, to try to get people's attention, to try to, as you said, break through that, you know, wall or film of denial that prevents us from moving forward. And I don't know what the answer is. You know, I don't, it's not like I took it, you know, my work in and of itself to do that, but lots and lots of people have been working on this. And so far, you know, it hasn't been successful. I think more and more people are aware of it and are concerned, but it hasn't been enough to raise this to the level where our politics have changed. And I don't know what the answer to that question is. I wish I had an answer for you.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Colbert, who has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1999. Her three-part series on global warming, the climate of man, won the 2006 National Magazine Award for Public Interest, the 2005 American Association for the Advancement of Science's Journalism Award, and the 2006 National Academy's Communication Award. She's the author of The Prophet of Love and Other Tales of Power and Deceit and Field Notes from a Catastrophe, and her latest book just out is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. So there have been, of course, associated with what we're talking about, Elizabeth Colbert, the so-called climate walls. Michael Mann, climatologist, has been under assault. One of the main engines of denial, if you will, is Fox News. And it's worth noting that the second biggest investor in News Corp, the family-owned or the family-controlled company by Rupert Murdoch and his family, after the family, the second biggest investors are the Kingdom Fund, which is the Saudi Arabian monarchy. So you understand where they're coming from. But my sense is that we appear to be reaching a point where the notion of national patriotism is becoming archaic, and that we really need to form a kind of global patriotism. And if we do have the climate wars between reality and the deniers, at a certain point, you know, we have to start calling people war criminals.
Well, that suggestion, you know, has been made, that this is, you know, a real getting to the point of as you say, sort of constituting, you know, crimes against humanity, preventing any kind of action to avert a potential, you know, crisis that will have really serious ramifications, probably especially for those countries and peoples, you know, who have contributed least to the problem. And I think there's a very, you know, very strong ethical case. I'm not sure I'd get to the level of war crimes, but there's a very strong case to be made, you know, that the behavior that is blocking action and is disseminating, people are disseminating, you know, misinformation, that this is beyond, you know, stupid and sort of politically beyond the bounds of what's politically acceptable, even in a society that accepts a lot of falsehoods as part of its political discourse, that this is really getting to a level of you know, behavior that ethically can't be tolerated. Now, what you do when you decide, okay, ethically this can't be tolerated, that, you know, that unfortunately gets us back to the question of how do you break through.
Well, one of the things that's pretty clear in our culture is that we admire men and women in uniform, and politicians always pay homage to our fighting men and women. Well, it turns out that the Pentagon are actually at the cutting edge of the recognition that climate change is a reality. So, by the way, is CIA and other intelligence agencies. The Australian Intelligence Agency, for example, believe that climate change is the number one security threat to Australia. So would that be helpful? Because clearly, as this new report from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change indicates, the combination of climate change with poverty that already exists and a shaky global economy could lead to war and drive people to leave their homes.
Yes, I mean, I think you raise a really good point, and there have been several reports, you know, that have gotten some press about various, as you say, defense departments and people whose job it is to look into the security threats of the future have identified climate change as very high up there on the list of destabilizing forces in the globe and potential sources of conflict going forward. And I think it's a good point that you raise, that, you know, those people are often you know, not associated, let's just say, with the most liberal politics, and that they would be very good way to sort of maybe bridge or break through this ideological divide. That hasn't happened either yet. I don't know whether that's because they haven't made it a priority. It would be a really interesting question if some of the, you know, really top people at the Pentagon said, okay, you know, we take this on to go talk to the top, you know, the committee chairman of the relevant committee, is that something needs to be done about this because it's a security threat. I would really like to hear those conversations. I unfortunately suspect they haven't taken place.
So in terms of your new book, Elizabeth Colbert, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, I've spoken before to Peter Ward, a paleontologist, who's published widely on biodiversity and the fossil record and is an expert on mass extinction, which he wrote about in Under a Green Sky, pointing out that all but one of the major extinction events in history, which the five and, until you brought up the sixth, have been brought on by climate change. So give us a sense of this sixth extinction then in terms of the record. Can you sort of put it in that context?
Well, the five, previous mass extinctions, which are scattered throughout the fossil record at very great distance from us, the most recent of those five is 66 million years ago. It's sort of the most famous, as it were, and most the one that did in the dinosaurs, and which was a pretty broad scientific consensus that that was caused by an asteroid impact. And what unites the previous five, I think, more than climate change, to be honest, is that there were moments of when the world changed very rapidly, too rapidly for many, many species to adapt. And that is what unites it with the sixth extinction, which is, happening or on the verge of happening right now, which is that we are changing the world very, very rapidly. Climate change is just one of the ways, it turns out, in which we're changing the world very, very rapidly.
So you have, of course, one of the bitter ironies about this is that so many of the countries, I have a friend, Cleo Pascal, who works with these island nations that are going under, and her big complaint is that they just don't have a lot of power. They never, they have seats in the General Assembly, but nobody much cares about them. Bangladesh, which is really going to be impacted, they have perennial problems. So is that a problem? Is that I suppose, though, on the other side of the coin, I guess you could argue that wealthy people in Florida who are going to, suddenly be inundated by the ocean, maybe they balance it out. But is that one of the ironies, that the constituency for those first affected doesn't have political clout in the global context?
I think that is one of the tragic ironies. That gets to the point that those are going to be, quite possibly most severely affected. Well, first of all, they're the people who are already living on the edge and don't take much to get pushed over the edge. But it's just true that the countries, very, very poor countries, have contributed relatively little to the problem, but they're going to, in many cases, for whatever reason, because of geography, in many cases, going to get hammered. And they're also going to get hammered because they do lack, the finances to, certain adaptive technologies are going to help. The Dutch have been living below sea level for centuries, as it were. They're a very rich country. Maybe they will be able to deal with significant sea level rise that's coming, but that doesn't mean that many other countries will. So, they're getting hit from all sides, sort of, and Bangladesh is sort of maybe becoming, and low-lying island nations, which are already preparing to decamp, and brought land on Fiji, for example, which is all itself being severely affected by climate change. But I also do want to raise the point, I don't think anyone should feel, and I think California's experience, increasingly is bringing this home to people in the U.S. and in the industrialized world. No one is immune. That is one of the lessons of today's report. No one is going to escape this unaffected. Now, as I say, the closer you are to the edge, the easier it is to push you over the edge. But, when global food supplies grow short, everyone on some level suffers.
Well, Elizabeth Colbert, I had some friends up nearby here in Santa Barbara who tried to come up with a form of activism that was very educational, which was to paint a little kind of logo of, the rippling waves of the ocean, just a little blue icon on buildings throughout Santa Barbara that indicate where the sea level will be in X number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what happened? The city closed them down because it was bad for tourism.
Right, right. It's very bad for real estate. I mean, a colleague, a friend of mine, actually wrote a piece about, you know, the prognosis for Miami, which, as you suggested, is really quite bad, both because of sea level rise and because of the way that the city is constructed on limestone makes it very, very difficult to protect it from sea level rise. And, you know, the local Chamber of Commerce sort of went berserk, went into overdrive about trying to deny that this is the case, but, you know, certain basic facts, unfortunately, are facts. Now, they are facts that can be, you know, conveniently ignored until the waves are lapping, you know, at that elevation. But they can't be ignored forever. And, you know, the whole point of going through these exercises of the IPCC reports is to try to get people to take action before, you know, really dreadful things happen. And this gets back to the fact that there's a lag in the system. What you see happening right now is not, in effect, the future is already now. We've already guaranteed certain outcomes. We've already guaranteed a fair amount of sea level rise. So we need to, and that gets back to the point that you made earlier, we need to both be aware of that and be planning for that, and we need to try to prevent those things for which no planning is possible, you know, things that are just beyond the scope of our being able to cope with them.
So, Elizabeth Colbert, is there a connection then between modern capitalism where, you know, the CEOs of big corporations can only think about the next quarter? There's a case, for example, of Verizon. They had a CEO that actually was a bit of a visionary, and he decided to opt to put fiber cable down, Fios it's called. But Wall Street canned him because the payoff was too many quarters in the future. You know, they were only interested in a quick buck, and he got fired. And then the irony is, of course, Fios is the biggest profit generator in Verizon. But that's how our capitalism works. And is that, I mean, my thought is that if you've got oil companies and the Koch brothers on one side who are pushing global warming denial for their own mendacity and profit, what about insurance companies, people like that who are going to take a bath? Can you organize a corporate constituency to fight the deniers?
You know, I think that is increasingly happening, that you do see a growing, you know, constituency among people who have a financial stake in a different kind of future. But I think that there's just the problem is with all political problems too, is that inertia is all, you know, you know, the tie goes to the side that just wants to keep doing things as we are, because that's what everyone is most comfortable with, you know. And this notion that Americans want change, which we say every 4 years, is, I think, you know, pretty patently untrue. We actually don't want change. Now, the problem is we're going to get change, whether we want it or not, and the question is, you know, to what extent are we going to do that in a conscious way, and to what extent are we just going to let the future sort of come at us? So I don't know. I really don't know if we have enough sort of far-sighted corporate leaders to put together, you know, any kind of really strong political movement. Once again, these are questions that we're going to find out. You know, we're in the process of finding that out.
Well, the Obama White House says it's taking this new UN report as a call of action, and Secretary of State John Kerry is saying the costs of inaction are catastrophic. What's your sense of our political leadership on this issue?
Well, I think the Obama administration does want to, you know, get something done before it leaves office, something significant. They've sort of given up on the legislative process, however, and you can't really blame them because it's pretty clear that that's not going to yield anything. So they're trying to take executive actions that would make some sort of difference, and that includes, for example, we should see regulations governing existing power plants and their carbon dioxide output that could have pretty dramatic impact on how power is generated in this country. Those will be litigated. The administration has waited till, you know, sort of the last possible moment that they could conceivably get done before they leave office. So, you know, you can't say that they've taken the most far-sighted and responsible course here. But, you know, given that they've sort of squandered a lot of time, they are trying to make a push towards the end of the administration to try to get something done.
Well, just in closing, Elizabeth Corbett, Hillary Clinton recently speaking at the University of Arizona, she told the students, or perhaps agreed with the students, I'm not sure exactly in the context of her remarks, were global warming is the defining issue of our time, and that this should be the next, in effect, student movement. What did you take from that?
Well, I took two things. I mean, first of all, I completely agree with her. I think young people really need to be aware. As I say, people tend to look at this problem and say, okay, well, it's not so bad right now. We still have time to deal with it. And this point that people really need to understand, as I said, can't stress enough, is that, you know, things are way, way past what you can see today. We've really locked in a lot of the warming for the next, you know, half a century already. So you can't just infer from what's happened this past year, this past week, this past month, to what's going to be happening in the future. And so I completely agree with Hillary Clinton that this should be young people's issues. They should be extremely angry about the world that they're being left with, the problem they're being left with, and they should demand change of a very, very dramatic and immediate nature. Now, that being said, I think that both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have sort of taken the same position, which is someone else should build the constituency for this sort of change. And the point that I would make is a responsible political leadership would be building that constituency. So, you know, I don't think that we should absolve them of responsibility.
Well, Elizabeth Corbett, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Corbett, who's been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1999. Her three-part series on global warming, The Climate of Man, won the 2006 National Magazine Award for Public Interest, the 2005 American Association for the Advancement of Science Journalism Award, and the 2006 National Academies Communication Award. She's the author of The Prophet of Love and Other Tales of Power and Deceit and Field Notes from a Catastrophe. Her latest book just out is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.